For those of you who don't know me, my name is Eric Austin. I'm the executive director of the Burton K. Wheeler Center. Again, thank you so much for coming out. This is a critically important topic. You can't go a day, can't go probably an hour without encountering an expression of the sort of hyper-partisanship and divisiveness that unfortunately has come to characterize much of our politics today. So I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk about both the causes and the dynamics that shape that divisiveness today, but also to begin to think about some ways forward, some different ways of doing things that are more functional, more effective. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation. At this point, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Brad Snow, who is the chair of the board of the Wheeler Center.
Good morning, everyone. And to echo Eric, thank you for giving up a Saturday for this. It is beautiful outside, but we'll try to make it beautiful in here, too, today. Hopefully some beautiful things will happen. I'm the board chair of the Burton K. Wheeler Center, have been since 2012. It's a real honor to represent the center and do work for the center. We're the only public policy forum that focuses on Montana issues in the state of Montana. We're housed at Montana State University, and we do important work. We tend to have one major public conference like this each year. They are always on different subjects, although occasionally after several years we'll double back and tackle a subject or do a different take on a subject again. We have not done a conference quite like this one ever before, although we did do a conference about 10 years ago on civility in the legislature when things seemed to be going awry in that department. Some of you may remember an outburst by a Billings legislator. And that was a very successful conference. We are unveiling a new and improved, vastly improved website soon. We're excited about that, so please visit us at www.wheelercenter.org. And that new website, I think, is going to much better represent us than the dinosaur website from about 2002, from the dark ages that we have right now. Anyway, thank you all for being here. The Wheeler Center does a variety of programming. You can find out more about it on our website. Among the programming that we do a politics and pizza series that's mainly geared towards students at MSU. We do Burton K. Wheeler lectures, and we do a variety of other types of programming. We're rigorously nonpartisan, and anyway, thanks for being here today, and I hope we have a great conference. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Brad. Want to move to our first panel as quickly as I can this morning, but I do need to say a couple of special thank yous to folks who have contributed and really made this event possible. First, I wanted to acknowledge Bob Breaux and Northwestern Energy for the contribution, the very generous contribution that they've made to help make this event possible. So thank you, Bob. I'd also like to acknowledge the League of Women Voters for a contribution that they've made as well. And I'd like to invite Claudette Morton to join me here for a moment to say a few words about an upcoming event that they've got going on that's very much consistent with the kinds of issues and concerns that we're going to be talking about today.
Thank you, Eric. I was pleased to see on the slide yesterday the League of Women Voters, and I want to tell you there are four of our, we have four chapters in Montana, and we really do work to provide more access to voting and to have informed voters. And if you're from Helena, September 20th at noon is our first meeting this fall, and we'll be looking at with the legislator at the possibility of more access to voting. The other thing that I do want to say, we have a state program that's going on right now, and we provide special events, and it is called Improving Democracy, And we had an interesting young man who spoke from, who's actually a Billings native, but he spoke from University of Philadelphia. Is a postdoc, and he's now on a Fulbright in Europe. And he talked about access to voting and so forth. And I'll just leave you with one critical fact that he pointed out. This election, 9% of the voters actually chose the two people that we have for candidates. So think about that as we go forward for other voting. But we're pleased to help sponsor this, and we're pleased to do a number of things in your communities.
Thanks, Claudette. One of the next activities along, or the next events along those very lines that we're at the Wheeler Center very excited to work with the League of Voters, Women Voters on, is a series of candidate forums that are going to be held in Gallatin County in Bozeman, mostly through the month of October. So check out our Facebook page, check out the League of Women Voters page to get more information about those candidate forums that are going to be coming up pretty soon. Without further ado, I want to invite our first panel to come up and take their seats at the table. We'll introduce them and then get the discussion for today started. So I'm pleased to introduce our first panel this morning. Just briefly introducing the panelists, starting on my left, Dean Nicole Ray from Montana State University, Dean of the College of Letters and Science, and my boss as well. Dean Ray is a scholar of American politics, including Congress. To his right is Bob Brown, who many of you know, longtime Montana politician, having served in statewide office and in the legislature. Chuck Johnson, longtime journalist following politics across the state. And Dan Kemmes, who was the mayor of Missoula, as many of you know, served in the legislature, has written a number of books on politics and grounding politics in place and local processes. So I am very pleased and excited to turn the floor over to our first panel today to talk a little bit about the background, history, dynamics, and how we got to where we are now.
Well, I guess I should start because I'm going to talk about the national picture, picking up on some of the themes from Ted Celeste's address. And these gentlemen are far more expert in Montana politics than I am. So I'm delighted to be here and have the opportunity to address this very important and timely issue. At the outset, I think it's important to point out that democracy and divisiveness are not necessarily incompatible. Without some degree of divisiveness, there would be no democracy, and spirited political debate should be welcomed. The problem arises when the degree of political divisiveness or polarization threatens the civic consensus necessary for democratic governance. As an example, and it's come up in this campaign, if election outcomes, for example, are not seen as legitimate, if that kind of consensus breaks down, then I think it does become threatening to democratic governance. And the degree of polarization, I would argue, over the last 30 years or so in American politics has had malign effects on effective governance. I'll explore that a little bit later in the presentation. I don't do so much active political science these days, but most of my career as a researcher has been in the areas of parties, elections, and national political institutions. And I would say for most of that career, I have wrestled with this issue of political polarization. It's surfaced again and again. The major research projects that I had on the decline of liberal Republicans, the decline of Southern Democrats, the Republican class of 94, and the last big one on the Clinton impeachment, polarization really factored into all of those. And to an increasing degree, as I went from one project to another. So if we look at what happened in American politics, you know, since I started doing this kind of work in the mid-1980s, we see the political parties are much more polarized. A key reason for that is that the Democratic and Republican parties map far more closely with ideology than they used to. So that conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans, who were crucial political players in the 1960s and into the 70s, have largely disappeared. You have a conservative party and a left liberal party, basically. And with that, almost inevitably, has come more party polarization. We see much higher levels of party unity in Congress and in legislatures, to a lesser extent, much more polarization in Congress, much lower levels of split-ticket voting. Again, when I was first starting to study American politics in the 70s, early 80s, split-ticket voting was a phenomenon that surfaced again and again. Ronald Reagan would carry states with 70% of the vote, and a Democratic senator would carry the same state in the same election with 70% of the vote. That doesn't happen to the same extent anymore. It'll be an interesting test this fall to see to what degree it happens, but it's far less common than it was then, and that has effects on how Congress operates and on the national government in D.C. The effects of all of this, then, a certain coarsening of political debate, which Ted talked about last night, and which I think, you know, I don't need to be too obvious in pointing out examples from the current presidential campaign, Lion Ted, Little Marco, birtherism, Harry Reid's assertion that Mitt Romney hadn't paid taxes for 10 years, which he's never apologized for or retracted, all of that, gridlock and governmental shutdowns, which I think have become pretty much not only commonplace but pretty much expected. When, you know, was the last time that we went through a budget cycle without having to go through the whole threatened shutdown performance that's now almost become like a Washington, D.C. kabuki? Loss of confidence in the governmental system. If there's anything that comes out of this election, and whichever way you try to test it, these right-track, wrong-track numbers or questions that ask more specifically about political institutions, the American public has lost confidence in their national government. No question about it. A failure to address pressing political issues, which, you know, go on without resolution. Immigration reform, entitlement reform, to name but two. Sometimes you almost get the suspicion that the political players are happy to keep the issue alive for their own purpose of rallying constituents rather than settle it. And then I think there's been a loss of consensus on what the U.S.'s role in the world should be. And it's become glaringly obvious in this campaign. That is very serious. Is the U.S. the indispensable nation? Should the U.S. pull back from its alliances, forge new kinds of alliances? Should it be going forth in foreign policy, looking for new fields to conquer? I mean, all of those things are somewhat up in the air, but I think there's been a total fragmentation of whatever consensus there was in the wake of, the failures in Iraq and Afghanistan, ongoing crises in the Middle East, issues of terrorism, and what to do about Russia and China and what our relations with those powers should be. So how did we get here? Well, I'll reiterate an earlier point that we now have a far greater alignment between the party labels and ideology since the 1970s. And both parties You see the impact of single-issue groups, or as they're referred to often by political scientists, policy demanders, which I think in some ways is a better name, although it's a little clumsy, on both parties. U.S. House and legislative districts, as Ted said last night, are now largely drawn to be safe for one party or the other. And members, therefore, have to respond to much more polarized primary electorates rather than the general electorate in most cases. And this increases the power of the policy demanders on each side because they have the troops, they have the infrastructure, and they have the funds. And I'll give you an example. When I did that book on the Clinton impeachment, I interviewed a lot of members of the House Judiciary Committee, Republican members, who voted to impeach President Clinton. And a recurring theme was, well, I wasn't really sure it was a good idea to impeach President Clinton, but the politically expedient vote was to vote yes to impeachment. Because I went back to the district, and the constituent groups from my own party, the folks who vote in the primaries, were telling me over and over again, impeach the SOB. That was literally the words that were used. I think that, if anything, has only intensified issue by issue. Because I was doing those interviews around, 2000, which is 15 years ago. Now, it can't all be redistricting either. It can't, because the Senate has followed the same trend to a somewhat lesser degree. And I think, in a lot of ways, the same constituent pressures apply there, too. There's a lively debate, I think, between those who see polarization as a top-down, as being sort of driven by top-down forces, and those who see it as being driven by bottom-up forces. I think it's a mixture of the two, but the top-down argument essentially is that polarization is a consequence of the impact of the single-issue groups, the policy demanders, the activists, the ideologues on campaign finance and campaign infrastructure. That the influence of political action committees and super political action committees, enhanced by the Citizens United decision, and we see the role, played in election campaigns by groups funded by the Koch brothers and George Soros. Increasingly partisan ideological news media, or new media, which lend themselves far more easily to being more partisan and ideological. Talk radio, then cable, then the internet and its associated social media. If you want to see extremism, just go onto a liberal or conservative blog and look at the comments. Not the blog itself, necessarily. Which may still be concerned with, some kind of rational argument, but just take a look at the comments, and they are frightening. To me, they are. both frighteningly uninformed and frightening in tone. The bottom-up argument, though, that, this isn't all driven by political elites, there are larger public constituencies for those new media. They don't exist in a vacuum. Second, it's a sad fact of life that Americans increasingly live, work, and socially interact only with the like-minded. There's an excellent book called The Big Sort by Bill Bishop that sort of captures this, but there's quite a voluminous literature on it now. And we have, this reinforces, I think, various divides in the electorate. We still have, I think, racial ethnic divides greatly alleviated, but which are still with us today. Certainly in the 80s and 90s, an increasing divide emerged between the more religious and secular voters. And then most recently, we see an increasing political divide between sort of working class, less educated voters it's been manifested in this campaign, but we also have an interesting literature in this by people like Robert Putnam and Charles Murray, who've written about basically a kind of civic breakdown where voters of different economic status no longer interact with each other in a way that they once did and live in increasingly isolated universes, reinforced by growing income disparities over the past quarter century or so. And this literature makes rather grim reading. There's even been some of it by people like Angus Deighton, Nobel Prize winner, looking at health, at statistics for middle-aged Americans and actual declines in some areas due to social factors leading to drug use and so forth. It's pretty chilling. So I would say the national picture is rather bleak, and I'm sort of throwing out a question for my fellow panelists here, because I've only been in Montana 4 years, so I try not to pontificate on Montana politics because I claim no expertise. But is Montana a different story? Well, here's my very superficial impressions, which they'll no doubt, rip to shreds, but that's what this panel's all about, so that's fine. Polarization of Montana still largely seems to be within parties rather than between them. In fact, within one party, I would say, the Republican Party. Moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats still exist in Montana, and they still have an impact on political outcomes. We have a Republican majority legislature that seems to be able to work with a Democratic governor and produce legislative outcomes at the end of each session. There seems to be a somewhat lower salience here of the polarizing national issues at the state level. I don't see the class disparities mapping onto politics to the same degree here. The state political culture, Montana is one of those states that seems to have a distinctive political culture. I lived in Florida for 24 years. Nobody talked about Florida values. In Montana, I'm intrigued, that both sides keep coming back to this Montana values. It's very interesting. I think you can look, at the 50 states and you see ones where there is something of a distinctive political culture. And I think Montana definitely does have that. And then one aspect of that culture that I find very interesting is that Montanans, not just on the left of the political spectrum, are very resistant to outside ideological organizations getting involved in elections. That's a big deal here. Those organizations were no less involved when I was in Florida, but really, beyond the op-ed pages, it didn't have much salience. I get the impression, Montanans, I think for historical reasons, really care about, ideological PACs from outside the state, whether right or left. And, there's a whole history in the state that may explain that, but that's very interesting. Well, I'll wrap up here. I've probably gone on too long, but given the current national presidential campaign, I don't see much grounds for optimism. Maybe a cataclysmic national defeat for one party or the other might be a wake-up call. Public exasperation with a national government that's increasingly perceived as dysfunctional, though, is definitely, I think, a threat to our democracy. Government by executive order, demagoguery, quick fixes, and so on lead to political crises. So maybe in terms of hope, we should look to the states, often regarded as laboratories of democracy. And, we can look at what's going on in Montana. Something else that's rather interesting, I think, is California's primary reform, which essentially they went to a top two system, which I mean, that partly happened because people thought it would have a moderating influence and reduce divisiveness there. It hasn't been in operation long enough for us to really test that, but that's interesting. But I think, to me at any rate, it increasingly looks like the state level is where a reformed, healthier democratic process can perhaps be reestablished. Thank you very much.
You know, there's an old saying that you never want to sit so far from the microphone that the applause dies down before you get there. And I was 7 feet away. So. Well, it's good to be here this morning. I know many of you. I'm Bob Brown. I think there's the impression that government used to work better than it does now. And I think it depends on the period in history we talk about, but in the lifetimes of virtually everyone in this room, I think that's accurate. And certainly from my experience with the Montana legislature, even though I haven't been there for 20 years, I think the legislature did work better, in the recent past. And I was there from 1970 to 1996. And there were partisan dust-ups and disagreements and that sort of thing during that period, but I think it was way different, at least based on my newspaper readers' understanding of the way things work there now. It worked better then. There was a lot of respect for experience and tradition then, that with term limitations aren't really possible now. There were old institutions such as the Anaconda Company, the Montana Power Company, the Montana Stock Growers Association, the Taxpayers Association, the FFL-CIO, the Farmers Union, Montana Council of Co-ops, Montana Education Association, and there were lobbyists for those interest groups that had been there for a long time. So there was stability that more or less went with that. And the senior lobbyists and the senior legislators pretty much ruled the roost then. There was a kind of an understanding that they were the seniors and that you kind of deferred to them on most decisions that were made. And they could make things happen during that period when I was a legislator. I was a freshman legislator in 1971, and I quickly perceived of how that system worked. And I was 23 years old, and I learned that it was a better idea, rather than asserting my own ideas, to persuade Matt Himsel or Gene Turnage or somebody my ideas were their ideas. And I managed to influence them to some extent, I think, from time to time. But it was a different culture, and it was almost a different system then, I think, than is the case now. The 1970s were described by Professor Harry Fritz, now retired from the University of Montana, as Montana's second progressive era. So you had a lot of new things happening in the 1970s that I don't think really changed the culture of the legislature. You had new ideas, new conflicts, new faces in the legislature, but the system and the respect for the system, I think, remained pretty much the same. And this was in spite of a major executive reorganization bill, a new constitution that had a major impact. The environmental movement occurred during that period of time. But I don't think it had much effect, really, on the legislative culture. There were still the same interests, still the same respect for experience, and still, and this is important, established old friendships, no term limitations. So the status quo could kind of carry on with minor course corrections, but still the system remained pretty much the same. The shared respect for the legislative process and the accepted recognition that we all had to make it work, that we had an obligation to make it work, was an all-pervasive understanding, I think, during this period of time. Some of you here may remember Governor Ted Swindon. Well, he was a major influence in keeping this concept moving along. He had friends on the Republican side, even though he was a Democrat governor. And he was a great source for stability during that period of time. And there were, it was commonly understood back when I think government was less divisive in Montana. There were mentor figures that had a lot of influence, and younger legislators tended to look up to them rather than take on their leadership. They tended to cooperate with it and learn what they could. How many people here have heard of Representative Francis Bardineau? Well, he was a perfect example. And many young legislators learned the culture of the Montana legislature at the knee of Francis Bardineau. Senator Gordon McCumber was another one on the Democrat side. Republicans, Gene Turnage and Bill Mathers had a big impact and a civilizing impact. My personal mentor was somebody, less of you had probably heard of, Senator Matt Himsel, had a big influence on me. And he again projected this same idea about how the legislative process should work and we should have respect for each other. Well, now there's big upheaval. And we ask ourselves, what's caused it? The Tea Party didn't just happen in Montana. It's a national phenomenon. And we have to wonder, well, why 10 or 15 years ago did this change rather remarkably and rather suddenly? And it certainly impacted the Montana legislature and Montana politics, but it's a national thing. There was a book written back in 1992 by an author named E.J. Dionne. Raise your hands. Who's heard of E.J. Dionne? Okay, good, great. Well, I read his book called Why Americans Hate Politics right when it came out back in 1992, and I thought, this guy is approximately my age, within a year or so, I think. And I thought, because I paid a lot of attention to politics. It's been my primary interest since I was probably a fifth grader. And so I thought, I've lived through the same time he's lived through and tried to pay attention to the same things that he's written about in this book. How is it that he has such a deeper, better analysis than I ever had? How he's put things together in a way that I never thought of. So recently he came out with another book. He's written several. And this one is entitled Why the Right Went Wrong. And it's a powerful book, but it's a pretty easy theme to understand. And it's that it just came out last year. And he suggests that the reason that the right went wrong is because of unrealistic expectations of political conservatives, beginning with Barry Goldwater. And the whole thing that started then was disdain for the establishment, that the little people in the Republican Party going to overthrow the wealthy country club boardroom Republican establishment, and that compromise is basically bad, that standing on principle is good. And you remember extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, moderation in defense of liberty is no virtue. And that's a courageous, powerful statement, but not a very unifying one, that's for sure. And Goldwater and people who were associated with Goldwater were very much opposed to Me Too Eisenhower Republicanism. We need a choice, not an echo. You associate with that period in time and with the Goldwater movement. We need to get the government back to basics. Let the people keep the money that they earn and not have the tax burden be as high as it is. And generally, many people agreed with these things, generally. But when it got down to specifics, they didn't. Tax cuts, let the people keep the money they earn, was popular. But then cutting government programs in order to do with less revenue was not popular, even among conservatives. Conservatives became increasingly angry, according to Dionne, when government failed to enact conservative ideas. Important results of tax cuts with no corresponding spending cuts was a national debt that's now $19 trillion. And that doesn't make conservatives happy. You think, how does it happen that we've had Republican majorities in Congress and Republican presidents? And over time, you can blame the second President Bush. You can certainly blame Obama. But you have to recognize that Republicans have had the majority in Congress during a lot of this time, too, and so they've got to be implicated in it. And still it's happened. They think, well, we've elected all these people. Why haven't they done the things that they've told us they believe in? Well, there's some pretty complicated explanations for that, but maybe the best one is the 60-vote rule in the U.S. Senate, which makes it impossible to get anything significant passed unless you've got a 60-vote majority, which neither party's ever had. And all they'd have to do is reform that rule. It takes a simple majority to, at the beginning of a session of Congress, to establish their rules. Some of them will argue that, but I think there's no question but what that's the case. So either party could do it, but they hide behind it, so they don't have to make the tough decisions. At least that's my impression. And so maybe the conservatives are being sold out in that respect. I don't know. But I think their expectations are unrealistic. I think that they want something that they think they want that perhaps they don't and that they really can't have. It's not a political reality to cut these popular social programs and at the same time balance the budget. We can't take care of the infrastructure in our country and at the same time spend billions and billions and billions of dollars on national defense. And a lot of this stuff are things that conservatives don't want to cut. So there's a real conundrum here that they face, and it makes them increasingly angry and increasingly frustrated. And the conservative politicians haven't really known how to handle it, so they've become demonized essentially by their own people, and this leads to things like the Tea Party and the rise of Donald Trump and divisiveness in democracy and disdain for democracy. The flames of this are all fanned by talk radio. The Fairness Doctrine, I think, is a big deal in terms of understanding this. The Fairness Doctrine was implemented by the Federal Communications Commission back in 1949, and it was rescinded by them in 1987. So most of us in this room spent a lot of our lives when the Fairness Doctrine was in effect. And we kind of grew up with the idea that that's the way things are and that's the way things should be. There wasn't the Fairness Doctrine before 49, and there hasn't been one since 1987. Guess who was nationally syndicated on the radio in 1988 and has had enormous influence, especially on the Republican side ever since then? I won't tell you his name, but his initials are Rush Limbaugh. Huge influence. More than 13 million people, it's estimated, listen to this guy every day. And he's smart and clever. He's an entertainer to some extent, but he has huge influence on the Republican Party. And I think he's there to stay. There have been efforts made to reinstate the Fairness Doctrine. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi and Dick Durbin, Democratic leader, or one of the Democratic leaders in the U.S. Senate, have proposed legislation to legislate the Fairness Doctrine back into effect. But about the same time that was occurring, then Congressman Mike Pence, now running for vice president, and a senator from South Dakota named John Thune, both Republicans, introduced legislation to prevent the Federal Communications Commission from ever reinstating the Fairness Doctrine. And neither bill passed. This is interesting, too. Bill Clinton very much supported reinstating the Fairness Doctrine and stated so publicly on many occasions. Of course, Rush Limbaugh never picked on Bill Clinton, did he? So he wouldn't have a motive for doing that. But President Obama, citing constitutional concerns, said he'd veto it if Congress did what Pelosi and Durbin wanted to do and reinstate it. Kind of an unusual development. But anyway, that's where we are now, and I think the likelihood is that's where we'll continue to be. And a lot of us could think, well, from the standpoint of free speech and not wanting to inhibit it and that sort of thing, maybe it's not entirely bad that the Fairness Doctrine was repealed. But I just mention that to you because I think sometimes openness and the old idea that the only way to improve democracy is with more democracy. And you couldn't make our system more democratic if you had less free speech, would make you think, well, to the extent the fairness doctrine inhibits free speech, maybe it had to go. But see, the result of that was what we're seeing now. And you think, well, if you're afraid of ideas, Bob, why do you castigate Rush Limbaugh? Well, I hope I'm not, but Rush Limbaugh has definitely been a destabilizing influence. Is it worth it? I guess it's for each of us to decide. Would it be necessarily bad if the radio stations and the television stations had to show balance and fairness in their news presentations? I'm not sure it would, but I can understand the constitutional problem with it too. But I think it's here to stay. I don't think we're going to get anything like the Fairness Doctrine back again. There's an article that I read to prepare for this, and I'll close with this. It might take me just a few minutes, but the article is really apropos of today's topic, and it's in the July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly, great, great, great magazine. And it's entitled, What's Ailing American Politics? And it's written by a Brookings scholar named Jonathan Rauch, R-A-U-C-H, and I'd recommend you read it. And I want to just touch on a few points he makes, because I hadn't thought about this in this way, and I hadn't really wanted to, but in spite of me, I think the guy makes some sense. But again, it's a hard trade-off. He argues that political parties and party leaders are disappearing. And leadership's vital to stability, right? So if you don't have leadership, you probably have chaos. Well, that's bad. You say, what's happened to the party organization, the party leaders? Well, Rauch indicates that Trump and Bernie Sanders, the final finishers in the recent presidential sweepstakes, are all insurgents. They were all pretty much out of line with their parties and with their party's leaders, and in some cases insulted their party's leaders. Jeb Bush attacked Trump as the chaos candidate, and he said he'd be the chaos president. And a survey right after that, taken right after that among Trump supporters, said that's one of the things they liked about him. Did Trump cause the chaos, or did the chaos cause Trump? Well, Rauch makes the case that the latter was the case, that the chaos, developing chaos, caused Trump, that the road in the direction of chaos began over a century ago, and get this, with the weakening of institutions and traditions within our political system. In other words, to a large degree, he blames the first progressive era for this. And he says that's a trade-off we made that we didn't realize we were making. Back then, he argues, we had power brokers. How did we refer to them? As bosses. And bosses are bad, right? Well, but he argues some of the things bosses did weren't bad in terms of stability and continuity and escaping from chaos. Party organizations, machines. So-and-so is a machine politician. He's the boss of the machine. Well, that sounds bad, but Rauch argues they didn't. All the things they did weren't necessarily bad. Career politicians are hacks. Congressional customs such as the seniority system, wrong and bad. Well, the old traditional system, extending back before Lincoln, was less than perfect, but it was functional, according to Rauch. Now, we may think functionality isn't worth giving up democracy and sunlight into the system, and that we prefer the progressive reforms. I think most of us in here would think that. That's what I've always thought. And yet, you can kind of make the case for the old status quo that maybe we went too far in some of this, maybe we overreacted in some of this, but it's always been popular to be against bosses and machines and the seniority system and pork barrel and that sort of thing. And so we've spent decades essentially attacking the established political order. And the result, Rauch argues, is disorder tending toward chaos, ideological polarization, radicalization of the Republican Party with the Democrat Party perhaps not too far behind. And there are a lot of pretty devout Bernie Sanders supporters who I think are very reluctant in their support of Hillary Clinton. He does suggest there could be some minor repairs, but he concedes that there's not really any realistic possibility of turning the clock back. He thinks one of the things that could happen is the elimination of legal limits on contributions to political parties. So if the parties were able to directly help somebody, there would be loyalty to the party on the part of the politicians from that party, because to be otherwise would bite the hand that feeds you and you might not get fed. And that's what the old political bosses used to be able to do, was they used to be able to move resources to candidates or starve candidates out of the resources. And restoring legislative earmarks. Again, kind of the same philosophy. There are wonderful stories about Lyndon Johnson, as a legislative leader. And when he needed votes for various things, he could get them by making sure that, in the case of the Civil Rights Bill, the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, Charlie Halleck, got a major pork barrel project in his district in Indiana. And going clear back to Lincoln, some of you saw the Lincoln movie, and you know that Lincoln wasn't bashful at all about giving things to people whose vote he needed for the 13th Amendment. And so earmarks, well, disgusting in some respects, maybe weren't that bad from the standpoint of making it possible for leaders to move important legislation. And then focus on sending unbound delegates to national conventions. So I read an interesting book here not long ago about Matt Quay, who was the political boss in Pennsylvania when Theodore Roosevelt was president and before, and Tom Platt up in New York. And they did everything they could in every Republican National Convention for a couple of decades to make sure that when the delegates went to the National Convention, they weren't committed to anybody. Well, with the big Pennsylvania delegation and the big New York delegation, Platt and Quay could largely control who the presidential nominee would be. And it's always pointed to as a classic example of how that system has been abused, and how by having primary elections and having delegates committed to the candidate that wins the primary election, we get away from that bossism and that controlled and brokered convention stuff and the smoke-filled room stuff and that sort of thing. Well, Ralph argues maybe that wasn't necessarily all bad. Are we going to get people to agree to going back to that? I doubt it. But he, I think, maybe as much as anything, wanting to make his readers think, has suggested that as something that could perhaps be done. I want to share with you, in conclusion, and it's not a very optimistic one, Rauch's conclusion in his article. The biggest obstacle, I think, and this could be the biggest obstacle to divisiveness in democracy, the biggest obstacle, I think, is the public's reflexive, unreasoning hostility to politicians and the process of politics. Neurotic hatred of the political class is the country's last universally accepted form of bigotry. Because this problem is mental and not mechanical, it is very hard to remedy. So I think now Chuck Johnson and Dan Kemmes are going to explain in very optimistic presentations how this is easily possible to remedy.
Thank you, Bob. I'm Chuck Johnson. Been a longtime political reporter in Montana and retired, but coming out of retirement next session to cover the legislature for the Bozeman Chronicle, and excited to do it. Thank you. Brad mentioned that the Wheeler Conference had a Wheeler Center had a conference in 2007 after the kind of the nasty breakup of the 2007 legislature, when the House and Senate, House controlled by Republicans, Senate by Democrats, adjourned without passing a budget. And on the final day, the majority leader of the House, Michael Lang of Billings, threw a fit in front of a camera at a Republican caucus and called out the governor and every curse you could imagine. And that was the atmosphere as the legislature closed. I was a panelist at the conference following that, and I thought long and hard about what to say, and I'll just tell you briefly, but I referred to a book I'd gotten somewhere along the way, All I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, and share everything, play fair, don't hit people, don't take things that aren't yours, and so on. But that was really the start of it, the breakup of the 2007 session. In 2008, we saw the formation of a group called Western Tradition Partnership, formed by two prominent Republicans, former Congressman Ron Marlaney and the House Appropriations Committee in Montana, John Sinrud. And they raised money to fight, quote, radical environmentalists. But it was really more than that, and we've since learned that it was really funded by the National Right to Work Foundation. But they, in the 2008, but more so in 2010 and 12, took on incumbent Republicans that they deemed unfit and ran particularly scurrilous campaigns against them. I don't have the brochures, but if someone voted for a certain bill that may have included money for sex education as part of the broader budget, they had vicious brochures and attacked them, and a lot of them lost their seats. Some who survived were pretty upset. In 2009, we had the formation of the Tea Parties around the country. I read a book I'd recommend called Dark Money by Jane Mayer of The New Yorker, who shows pretty conclusively these were not bottom-up groups, but top-down by the Koch brothers, funded by the Koch brothers. And they created a lot of they inspired a lot of people, and they took after a lot of incumbent legislators. 2010, we had Citizens United, the decision that essentially freed up, the U.S. Supreme Court decision that freed up corporations and unions, which, of course, had a lot less money to basically contribute as much as they wanted in political races. So that's kind of the atmosphere we're talking about. I'm choosing to talk more about the background of divisiveness in our state, a little about the country. And our politics and democracy have always been pretty divisive from the start, long before there were anonymous blogs attacking candidates personally, both nationally and in the states. There were pamphlets, pamphleteering, often anonymous. In the 1800 presidential election, a Federalist pamphlet called Democratic Republican Thomas Jefferson, quote, a mean-spirited, low-lived fellow, the son of a half-breed Indian squaw, sired by a Virginia mulatto father, as well known in the neighborhood where he was raised wholly on hoe cake, and that's from coarse southern corn, bacon and hominy, with an occasional change of fricasseed bullfrog, for which abdominal reptiles he'd acquired a taste for during his residence among the French. And a Democratic Republican pamphlet attacked John Adams of election fraud. It attacked his famous temper, saying, the reign of Mr. Adams has been one that contained tempest of malignant passions. The Republicans circulated an unlikely rumor that Adams had sent his running mate, Charles Pinckney, to England to procure four girls as mistresses, two for each man. Montana's had its history of vicious attacks in its rough-and-tumble politics. For many years, the most devastating political hit someone could make on another person was to brand him, and it was usually him, except for Jeanette Rankin, as a company man. And here's one against Wellington Rankin, Jeanette's brother and a frequent Republican candidate for office. It says, Mr. Rankin, you named the Anaconda Copper Mining Company as one of the special interests which you charge dominate and control state government in Montana. The Montana Record Herald and the Butte Daily Post are each owned by the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, are they not? They are both supporting you, are they not? Why? This is from the Democratic State Central Committee. I don't know what year it was, but I'm guessing it was the 20s. Opponents of the namesake of the Wheeler Center, Burton K. Wheeler, actually published an entire book in 1946 against Wheeler, The Plot Against America. Senator Wheeler and the Forces Behind Him, A Startling Exposé of the Coming Fascist Terror in Montana. And it's filled with little cartoons of Wheeler and a showgirl that he supposedly was hanging out with, and I'll show it to anyone who'd like to see it. The other senator, long-serving senator, was James Murray. And what did I do with that one? It must still be in my thing. Finding it, but it was, here it is. Senator Murray and the Red Web Over Congress. This was during the height of the McCarthy movement. Read the facts, the story of communist infiltration of your U.S. Congress from official records and common communist documents. This was actually published by his opponent, Wesley Duart, in the election in 1954, so at least he Duart could be held responsible for it. When Congressman Mike Mansfield ran for the U.S. Senate in 1952, he was derided as, quote, China Mike, unquote, by his foes. You know, another way to call him a communist. Our lunchtime speaker, former Congressman Pat Williams, was the victim of a cruel attack in the early 1990s when Pat Robinson's Christian Coalition and related groups dubbed him Porno Pat. It was alleging that grants from the National Endowment for the Arts funded what they called pornographic photography exhibitions by Robert Mapplethorpe, which wasn't in fact true. What Williams did in fact was engineer a bipartisan compromise to renew the NEA's status. And the sponsor in the Senate was Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah. The Montana Democratic Party in 2002 almost destroyed Max Baucus's opponent, Mike Taylor, a Republican state senator from up in the Flathead, with a particularly brutal ad that strongly suggested Taylor was gay because he had been a hairdresser 20 years earlier. It showed a video from an ad taken of Taylor working on a woman's hair. He had later become wealthy from starting a chain of hair salons, barber schools, and a company that manufactured hair products. The ad was so vicious that Taylor actually dropped out of the race a couple of weeks before the election, later got in and was trounced. One of the most insidious developments, in my opinion, in U.S. and Montana politics has been through these anonymous comments at the end of stories and blogs. And folks can say almost anything they want without any limits. And I'm an advocate of free speech, but I think these go a little far. I used to do stories occasionally on hunger in Montana, and we would work with the food banks to find people that were willing to talk about their problems, how they couldn't feed their children, and they'd have to, you know, scramble to get a meal when the food stamps started running low. And it wasn't easy, but we found people that were willing to share their life stories and some of the problems they faced that led them to being what was called food insecure. Inevitably, anonymous comments would come online and attack these people and telling them to get off their lazy butts and find jobs when, in fact, some of them were disabled and unable to find work. A week ago Sunday, the Billings Gazette announced it would no longer run any comments after stories online. NPR made the same call about 3 weeks ago. And earlier this year, the Montana Standard said they would continue to run comments, but only if they contained people's names, if people were willing to go public with their names. I applaud these decisions. I believe they'll lead to a more civil discourse. The writers of these comments can still write letters to the editor, which are subject, of course, to having your name on them. This is a little off the topic. We talked about it a little last night. I've long advocated that the Montana legislature sit alphabetically, A to Z, instead of by party, Democrats on one side, Republicans on the other, and facing off like the Roman legion fighting another country. They pretty well fell on my columns fell on deaf ears. But when delegates gathered in 1972 to write a new Montana constitution, they did just that. And it was a successful move, I think, to take partisan politics out of the convention and to show the public they could work together to draft a new constitution. The advantage, I think, is you would get to know people from the opposite side. You might not agree on anything, but you get to know that person, and maybe there's a bill or two you could agree on. Well, to my surprise, in July, Time magazine had an issue about kind of things we could do to improve America, and Garrison Keillor suggested something different, but a little something similar, but a little different with members of Congress. He wrote, quote, "Change the seating in Congress to mix Democrats and Republicans together. Teachers know you break up gangs by keeping them apart in the cafeteria." He suggested seating politics by seniority, with the old ones in the back, the new ones down front, so they get the idea that their time is brief. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be part of this discussion, and I'm looking forward to how it unfolds as the day goes on. My name again is Daniel Chemis. I'm from Missoula. I served in the legislature with Bob Brown while Chuck Johnson was covering the legislature. This was most of my service was back in the 70s and 80s. Bob mentioned mentors in the legislature, and Francis Bardnoff, whom he also mentioned, had a tradition of choosing one incoming Democratic freshman to sit next to him on the floor of the House. And I had that privilege during my freshman year. Francis never went out of his way to instruct, but just being near him and watching the way he operated was an education in itself. I ended up going from the legislature, where I had had a chance to get into leadership, and in that place I could engage in my youthful fascination with politics. And I loved being there, and I loved doing politics, but I came to feel that there was something that seemed to make it really difficult for any substantial agreement to be made with people across the aisle, which puzzled me in the sense that it was clear that everyone in that chamber loved being Montanans and cared deeply about Montana. And so it came to be sort of a puzzle to me just exactly what is it that given that how much we share, that makes it so difficult for us to realize those deeply held shared values in policy. That eventually led to my turning my attention to where I thought it might be possible to explore a little bit more that power of shared place, and that is local government. And so I ended up then spending the better part of a decade in City Hall in Missoula, and most of it in the mayor's office. And it's really that experience that I want to draw on this morning, for this reason, that I've become convinced that while our politics and our governing institutions suffer from all the ills we've talked about already and will all day, while all of that is true, my experience is that at the local level and across the country, that the people of America, and certainly the people of Montana, continue to be very good at doing democracy in the basic sense of solving shared problems and realizing shared opportunities. And that was so much my experience in city government and has been in the years since then. And I invite you to think of your own experience. Think of your own community. Think about what I suspect are the great variety of ways in which you and your neighbors take responsibility for the well-being of your community and figure out ways of resolving the issues that arise, or of seizing opportunities to make your place a better place to live, to raise children, to pass on to children. I ask you to do that because I'm convinced that democracy at any higher levels can never be stronger than democracy as it's practiced by people on the ground. And I think this is consistent with what I think of as the best analyses of democracy throughout history. I think particularly of Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where he identified so strongly the tendency of Americans to get together and form associations and figure out how to get things done. And even though Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone has made the argument that we've lost a lot of that, my experience is it's still alive and well. And it's to that basic sense of citizenship that we have to look for the healing of the larger institutions. However, I am concerned that in various ways, I think we have, in fact, let some of that basic strength of the body politic decay and weaken. And sometimes we have done it by the unintended consequences of the very best of intentions. And I believe that my own side of the aisle, the liberal side, has done its share of generating unintended consequences that have sometimes weakened the body politic. And I just wanted to suggest at that point that while I'm all for progressive principles in general, that conservatives throughout history have argued that it's important to be careful about making changes for the best of intentions if you haven't thought through what the consequences might be. So let me just suggest a few places where I think we have weakened the body politic for the best of intentions. And the idea is just to ask, are there ways that we might be able to reverse any of that? And I'll start with Citizens United. Now, Citizens United, to my mind, is the worst decision of the U.S. Supreme Court since Dred Scott. I think it's just deadly for American democracy. But I want to point out that the ACLU filed a brief in support of Citizens United. And it's not, I'm not here to pick on the ACLU, but I do want to make the point that that there's a whole range of essentially liberal ideology that has strongly advanced the idea of protecting freedom of expression. Bob mentioned it in talking about the fairness doctrine. Now, expression, freedom of expression, is a great thing, and it's tremendously important. But it actually is not the core of why we defend free speech in a democracy. Free speech in a democracy matters because we need to deliberate together. We can't do a good job of deliberating unless we're free to say what needs to be said, not to express ourselves, but to engage in conversation with our neighbors so we can solve those problems and realize those possibilities. But I would argue that we have put so much emphasis on the expression side of free speech that we've almost totally lost track of the democratic dimension of free speech. As soon as we think of free speech in a democratic setting, we recognize that you have to have limits. At city council, we allow citizens to come and speak, but we don't allow them to talk all night. And yet that is the doctrine that has come to apply to campaign spending as speech, as if because you should have a right to express yourself, you should have an unlimited right to express yourself. Democracy doesn't work that way, and we know it quite well. So let me just give a couple of other quick examples that at least I hope might be provocative of things that are well-intended that I think have actually sometimes made the functioning of democracy more difficult. Here's one: one person, one vote. Now, of course, I'm not opposed to the idea of one person, one vote. But when you think about community as the core of a functioning democracy, think about how the application of one person, one vote has changed the effectiveness of community. Before the one person, one vote rule went into effect, Montana elected its representatives to the House and the Senate countywide, so everyone ran within a whole county. Now, afterwards, we did it by single-member districts. Now, I am convinced that one of the results of that is that legislators find it now very difficult, aside from Butte legislators, to represent a community as a community. It before the rule went into effect, there was a very strong sense of representing communities. Afterwards, ideology and interest groups came to dominate the attention of legislators, and community had far less effect. I'll just get now. I'm not against one person, one vote, but there are ways that we could approach that principle that would maintain that sort of living body of democracy and its effect, give community more weight and interest and ideology less. I'll mention just one more. Educational equalization. Now, that seems like a good idea, to make sure that the poorest school districts in the state have a chance to provide as good education as the richest school districts in the state. That's a good, strong principle. The effect of it has been to undermine seriously the ability of communities to set educational standards, to make educational excellence something that they can really put their resources into. So we just passed a huge bond issue in Missoula, but all of the money has to be used for infrastructure and buildings because we have no way to raise our own taxes for the sake of instructional excellence. Now, again, I'm not against equalizing education, but my point is that in many of these instances that we put in place progressive policies that have actually undermined the sense of responsibility that people have and can exercise for their own community. And it's at that level of exercising responsibility that democracy has always had its strongest meaning. And it's there, I think, that we have to look for healing the body of democracy. Thanks.
I think we've got just a couple of minutes to take a few questions. If you have anything you'd like to follow up with the panel on, or questions you'd like to pose. Again, what we're going to do here, because we're trying to capture the audio, we'll hand you the stick mic if you've got a question and give you a chance to at least pose a couple of questions to our panel before we take a quick break.
Thank you for a wonderful discussion. And I want to ask you to reflect on the speaker last night, Ted Celeste, and what he said, his program about getting legislators to reach out, right, and make friends with someone who's fundamentally different. And for those of you, I don't want to neglect you, Dean Ray, but for those of you who've had experience with the legislature, do you think that this would be one effective way to address some of the problems that we have with divisiveness?
Is this on? Okay. When I was in the legislature, we frequently co-sponsored the bills that we introduced with members of the other chamber. And so even if it was an uncontroversial bill, I'd get a Democrat in the Senate, and I'd get a Democrat and a Republican in the House. And I'd make sure they were on board and not just doing it. I'd look to people who were on the committees where the legislation was likely to go, and that gave me an opportunity to acquaint myself with people, especially over in the other body. And that was more common then than it is now. When there are term limitations, things like that, considerations like that, long-term friendships and getting to know people and recognizing that you may need to work with them again, I think we're somewhat more important now. I think part of the reason that we've got this ideological focus seems greatly in my party, but I think also significantly in the other party. I mean, at least here in Montana, there aren't any old cowboy Democrats anymore. None. And there aren't very many, but I guess I couldn't even point to one. That I used to describe myself as a unreconstructed Theodore Roosevelt bull moose progressive Republican, and I'd get a chuckle when I do that. Now, if I described myself that way in the Republican State Convention, I'd have to be dodging the cream pies. So there just aren't very many Republicans anymore that would confess that at least at some point in their life, and I think I'd still confess that. I consider myself a progressive Republican. Well, Dean Ray's book describes us as an extinct species along with the Southern Democrats. And so the Republican Party is very ideological. Democratic Party is very ideological. And I don't think that's very good. And it used to be easier to go talk to somebody and get them to co-sponsor your bill and you become a friend. And when their bill comes over to the Senate, you help them. And the old network worked pretty well, in my opinion.
I'll just say very briefly that I think Bob is exactly right that term limits have done more to undermine the sort of the old-fashioned way of legislators getting to know each other and knowing how to work together than any other single factor. I mean, it's helped some by the fact that, of course, legislators have figured out how to get around term limits to the extent that they can by moving back and forth from one house to the other. But if you don't have a substantial core of senior people, it's very hard to maintain a sense of what it takes to get things done.
Just as both parties in Congress have their congressional campaign committees, now we have legislative campaign committees in both parties that are well-funded and target and, you know, send out pretty nasty mailers. So that makes it hard, too, to work with someone when they might be on the legislative campaign committee that put out the brochure that attacks you. It's hard to go shake hands afterwards. But I think term limits is the major factor.
Excellent insight, wisdom. My question has to do with how we reconstruct a kind of consensus reality so that we can legislate together. And what I'm talking about here is my sense is that the parties are operating in mutually exclusive universes of fact such that they're not even able to agree on what the problems are, hence how to arrive at solutions. And part of that difficulty, I believe, that is kind of the absence of a consensus reality, is the loss of mainstream media. And frankly, a deep distrust of it. And I'll confess that even as one citizen, the corporatization of media makes me suspicious, and I tend to discount traditional outlets such as the New York Times, et cetera. Maybe this is a question for Chuck. Chuck, do you have optimism about the future of mainstream media such that we can return to a moment, and maybe I'm being nostalgic, falsely so, return to a moment where we can agree on these are the core set of facts, these are the difficulties, these are the problems, now let's get at them. And we may well propose very different solutions, but at least we're agreeing on the problem.
Well, as all of you may know, a mainstream media in Montana and across the country face great problems financially. The internet has totally changed the equation. Many people don't subscribe to their daily paper in their town. They look online for news. You can kind of get around it and maybe catch a snippet of a story. I don't see that changing. The subscriptions or the circulations of even the largest papers in the country have fallen. Although the New York Times has found a model, you can subscribe to the daily New York Times online for $20 a month, which is quite a steal, really. There are other media emerging, online media, outlets like the Missoula Independent, Last Best News in Billings, which is an online-only publication, I guess you could still call it. Missoula Independent is a printed one, but also online. I think we're in an unsettled period. I don't know what will happen, but I think the public that's really informed is going to demand more coverage, more poking around at issues than the media are able to do now. And part of the reason the media is hurting is their financial problems are causing fewer reporters to be hired. They're pushing out senior reporters. So you have largely inexperienced journalists at a lot of places that are not very well paid. They come out of college with student loans. They can't afford to pay them off at the salaries they're being paid. So there's a more constant turnover than there used to be. I don't know how that changes. I think I read somewhere that of millennials, they don't buy landline phones. I have nephews and nieces that I ask them, no landline phones. None of them subscribes to a newspaper either. Well, that's where you kind of got to hook people when they're that age. And if you don't catch them in their 20s, I don't think you're going to get them in their 30s and 40s and 50s. So I'm not sure that's going to change. How do we get that? Well, maybe broader-based statewide online newspaper or magazine format is the hope, but those are difficult to fund. I know several people that are doing it, trying to do it, Martin Kidston, Missoula, with Missoula Current, and there isn't much financial support, and so I'm not very optimistic at present, but I hope that changes.
Take one more question.
Wonderful panel. It was just a treat to get to listen to all four of you. A couple of footnotes and then a question. Footnotes, interestingly, Citizens United goes back to the application of the First Amendment to commercial speech, which brought us ads for lawyers and ads for pharmaceuticals with those scary, scary disclaimers. And you could argue things kind of went off the track there. And then the Atlantic article, which was fantastic, in part traces back at least to David Broder's 1970s book, The Party's Over. So people have been worried about part of those trends, at least that far. Question has to do with the relationship between culture and structure, I think both are important. So at Northwestern, we serve Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, and a really cool little corner of Wyoming. Big, big differences culturally between Montana and South Dakota. And Bob and Chuck both talked a lot about the history. And that's profound. And you get to Nebraska or Dean to the UK where you went to school, unicameral legislature, nonpartisan, very different, every vote matters. Then in the UK, arguably an example of American politics coming to Britain with the decision by a Tory prime minister to have a plebiscite about Brexit, and that didn't go so well for him. So huge political disaster, but they got through it and probably picked the right woman in a matter of weeks. And then, of course, in that campaign structure, you can't spend that much money because there's not that much time for a campaign. So you've touched on both sides, but you recognize our culture, which is in part from our history, and then the structural issues too. So how do you bring those together? And then, Dan, I always appreciate you talking about culture at the local level. And if we could kind of bring that up to the state level, and wouldn't that be a wonderful thing too? Thank you all.
I didn't mean to see the show, but it definitely
I'll just say briefly that I was very interested in the dean's comments about Montana and sort of Montana pride and so on. I don't know where things stand these days in those terms. There was a time when there seemed to be a widespread sense that there's something special about being Montanans, and that should lend itself to a desire to do well by the state. My own experience has been that a lot of that sense of pride is that it's expressed less often, and what I hear more often is the bemoaning of our relatively poor economic status. From my perspective, the main reason that Montana ranks low economically on a lot of indices is simply that we're more remote from big metropolises than any place else. And so it's a given that our per capita income will be lower. But to the extent that we make it a political contest to figure out who can do the best job of complaining about Montana's economy, it doesn't do a lot to build that sense of we can do this.
I mean, maybe I was being Pollyanna-ish about Montana because I'm still a relative newcomer here. I mean, I do think that, and perhaps it's just a function of size, you know, that Montanans are able to engage politically across the divides a little more easily than I think is the case in much of the country. And that's not to say that the national forces haven't impinged here, and, you know, my colleagues on the panel have done a good job of pointing that out. I mean, one concern I think that I note in the state, and maybe a growing political significance, is we have sort of pockets of plenty. Like my own home, Gallatin County, the city of Bozeman, the Flathead area, which, you know, we see sort of economic growth, construction, in migration, and increasing prosperity, and then large segments of the state that aren't part of that. And I would see that as potentially worrying, I think. I mean, it has an ups. It's great for the communities that are benefiting, I think, for the state as a whole. And also, we get back to that class divide issue. It's kind of intriguing, and I'll sort of give you an anecdote. I lived in South Florida for a long time, and we have some South Floridians in the audience who probably agree with me. I went to a fundraiser in Bozeman shortly after I got there with a fellow, former Florida resident, who's a fundraiser, and she said, you know, the really hard thing here in Bozeman is you can't tell who has money and who hasn't. Whereas in Florida, it was easy. So maybe that's encouraging in a sense that, you know, there are interactions across the class divides here. They aren't so visibly stark as in other parts of the country. You know, I think I take the idea of laboratories, democracy seriously, because I think the national picture is grim. And I think the pattern there only gets broken. Maybe it takes a crisis of some kind to sort of concentrate minds, to sort of, you know, get beyond the gridlock, which, you know, I can't see that being broken no matter who wins the White House, to be frank with you. And I'm not being entirely flip here. I mean, whoever wins, I think there's a, you know, it's maybe not an even chance, but there's some chance we'll see another presidential impeachment in the next 4 years. And not simply because of the polarization and the likely continuation of divided government at some level. But I think, you know, we need to look at, I think, state governments as potential models as to how we can get out of this. And so I just reiterate that point.